straight on then. And it was in his talk on the Book of Revelation at his Oxford Summer School in 1948 that John Dorley said of the fruit-bearing tree of life the following: 12 manner of fruits, he said, is the divine fact behind what are called periods in the female and are associated with conception. Many women have proved that it is quite unnecessary in Christian science to have periods, and to stop them doesn't prevent conception. Well, one even hears these so-called periods spoken of sometimes as the curse, doesn't one? And therefore, remembering how the woman in Revelation 12 has the moon with its 12 monthly phases in subjection under her feet, we read in the book called Collectanea, and it's on page 109, of where Mrs. Eddy herself is reported as saying, "The first experience of mine in entering upon the discovery of Christian science was the entire stoppage of the periods that are believed to be concurrent with the moon. Hence that saying of the Revelator of the spiritual idea, the moon was under her feet." And she says virtually the same thing on page 14, the page where Jesus himself is quoted as answering the question, "When shall the dominion of death cease?" And he says, "As long as material birth continues. For I came to destroy the works of birth." As long as there's material birth, there's bound to be material death. Isn't that so? But only the destruction of birth on a mortal basis, of course, which is surely in line with what the textbook means when it says, and this is page 529, that another change will come as to the nature and origin of man, and this revelation will destroy the dream of existence, reinstate reality. That's really reinstating Adam's lost rib. Usher in science and the glorious fact of creation, that both man and woman proceed from God and are his eternal children belonging to no lesser parent. Well, now let's turn to the pure science and system of Christian science, where all this begins to be spiritually understood and the ultimate salvation of humanity begins to be perceived, including the understanding of the dreamlike unreality of the mortal birth-death belief. And it's where we see the tree of life equated with the order of the seven of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, and the four-headed river flowing forward as the water of life itself, equated with the symbol of the four of the word Christ, Christianity, science. so that when in the 1940s these four channels or orders of the seven synonymous terms for God were for the first time being scientifically understood, that is, when the orders on pages 465, 115, 587 of the textbook were being seen to characterize the Word, the Christ, and Christianity as the first three sides of the Holy Four Square City, and the fourth order, the science order, was found to be symbolized by Israel's golden candlestick with its six outspread branches. Then it was that John Dorley showed at the same time how this fourth order corresponded also to the tree of life itself with its outspreading branches. Because then it was that during the years of the Second World War, this conception of the four orders of the seven terms, like the rivers or channels into which our thought is gathered, you remember, in the third day of creation for the purpose of molding and forming our identity and bringing this spiritually to birth, this led to the evolving of the symbol that has been named the Matrix. Typical, in Paul's words, of the Jerusalem above, which is free, which is the mother of us all. Because in this symbol, as we can see at a glance, the seven and the four are wedded together, aren't they, in one conception. And it's where most wonderfully, as we shall find in a moment, the tree of life with her 12 manner of fruits is seen yielding her fruit every month. At the point of each of the 12 months of the year, that is, in accordance with the Earth's annual journey around the sun, or when the sun itself appears to move through those 12 major constellations of the heavens, known as the 12 signs or houses of the zodiac. Now, please, let's register this very carefully because of what's to come in a moment. And we let it register by turning, first of all, to a symbol that is so very well known to us, which is called the cross and crown, or the Christian Science seal. Might this possibly relate to the seal of the living God in the forehead of each one of us? I wonder. Because what comes to light through careful examination is that the Christian Science seal incorporates symbolically no less than the cyclic movements of the stellar cosmos itself. Difficult to credit? Well, wait and see. Do we realize, for example, that what the cross illustrates is the rotating, revolving earth, and the crown of 12 seven pointed stars, only five of which are visible because of the angle at which the crown is shown, illustrates the path traced annually by the sun in relation to the 12-fold circle of the major constellations of the heavenly firmament. Because are we aware that the angle of inclination of the cross relative to the crown is precisely that of the angle of inclination of the earth itself as it rotates upon its axis on its journey around the sun, namely 23.5 degrees? Remarkable? Well, test it for yourselves with a protractor and you will find that it is so. Now we see at a glance, of course, that the outer circle which encloses the cross and the crown is made up of those four Christly commands relative to world healing, isn't it? Four groups of three words each, making, once again, a 12-fold circle. But what isn't so obvious, and which possibly at first is hard to believe, is that the number of letters comprising these 12 words is exactly 52. The same as the number of weeks making up the annual cycle. Each week being composed, of course, of 7 days. No wonder the text of the fourth day of creation says of the stars that constitute the heavenly firmament, let them be for signs, that's symbols, and for seasons, four seasons, and for days, 7 days, and for years, the annual cycle of the 12 months. Extraordinary, the symbolism, isn't it? Well, hold on, because there's more to come. Because doesn't our thought at this point want to go to that other instance in Christian Science of where the globe is encompassed once a year, namely by the subjects of those 52 lesson sermons, actually 26 different subjects, but repeated every 6 months, that Mrs. Eddy drew up apparently to represent the complete cycle of the workings of Christian Science relative to world consciousness. Today, of course, our aim is to acquaint ourselves not merely selectively with the contents of the Bible and Science and Health, as in the case of the lesson sermons, but holistically, that is, with the two books in their scientific wholeness. Nevertheless, perhaps we ought to be more aware of the sequential flow of the subjects themselves. The subjects that day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, were designed to cater for the needs of mankind. Now here really is an outstanding example of one of these subjects. Do you remember the one? Is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? Well, apparently Mrs. Eddy once said to students that Christian Science must give the correct answer to this question to the world by the year 2000, or in her words, all will be destroyed by fire. Presumably, don't you think she was foreseeing the destructive power of atomic energy and its use in possible nuclear warfare? So what a subject that is, never to lose sight of, isn't it? As we learn to answer this question's universal implications individually with the spiritual and scientific understanding of science itself, undoubtedly this is preparatory to its being given to the world and saving the world from destroying itself. Well, let's come now to that much more recent symbol relative to the same underlying truth about the indestructibility of the cosmos, and that is the way in which the idea of the four-square matrix of immortality, to use the science and health phrase, evolved in John Dorley's thought, and how, through its two basic elements of the seven and the four, we are able today to see it pertaining to the tree of life and the river of life in a single immaculate conception. A conception which, unlike that of the material atom, is incapable of being split. How wonderful it is to know, therefore, isn't it, that what the infinite is, as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, and the way in which infinity functions as the Word, Christ, Christianity, science, is the very force itself by which the universe, including man, is evolved and maintained, rather than its being evolved by atomic force. So please make use now of the little supplementary chart that accompanies this recording called Tree of Life. Do you have it there? With the four orders on the left and the symbol of the matrix on the right, and with the golden candlestick and or the Tree of Life at the bottom of the page, really epitomizing both the seven and the four. And also that little chart depicting also the Christian Science seal. Now, except that one has left out the uncapitalized headings which Mr. Dorley used to describe the groupings of the different synonyms for God, the 16-fold symbol reproduced there outlines the matrix just as he left it. And it derives, doesn't it, from the original four orders or four channels of the synonymous terms, parted, like the river in Genesis, into four heads, for the purpose of our being able to understand the individual meaning of each order in turn. But just as the four sides of the holy city comprise one indivisible city, So the four rivers are shown at the end of Revelation in the form of one ever-flowing river of eternal deathless life. Now we do see that, don't we? And the reason, the fact that each of the city's four equal sides, therefore each of the four orders themselves, must necessarily reflect in itself the qualities of the other three sides in order to furnish the idea of one unfragmentable city and therefore one universal river of life. Not that the river loses its original quality of fourness, but now we see it flowing as only one river, albeit symbolically fourfold. And what John Dorley saw, therefore, was that within the scope, first of all, of the word order, is reflected the tones, the qualities of all four of the Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science orders. Likewise, within the scope of the Christ order is reflected the operational tones of the same four orders, and so on with the Christianity order, and lastly, the Science order. And this means that gradually, the structure of the four square matrix, as he left it with us, began to build itself up until finally, just at the end of the war years, there it was, complete. What he saw, in other words, and please follow this carefully and easily on the little chart, what he saw was needed to convey the idea of the Word purely in its own aspect as the Word, was the idea of God as mind, as spirit, and as soul. You see those three terms there in the matrix's opening section? Yes. And what was basically required to convey the meaning of the word in its aspect as the Christ was the idea of God as soul, as principle, and as life. And so on. And so on, until at last all 16 tones implicit in the original four orders had evolved and had formed the structure as a whole. You see the 16 groupings of terms, don't you? And how they evolve from the sequences of the original four orders. So may we leave it at that for the moment and turn to another very important basic factor. Because what we must acknowledge is that not until the Word, for example, is seen in the fullness of all its four tones, has the science of the Word appeared, or has the Word appeared in its divine science. Is that nice and self-evident? And not until the Christ has likewise appeared in the fullness of the same four tones has the Christ appeared in its science. and so on in the case of Christianity and science. Now, we are happy about that, aren't we? You see, the whole mighty emphasis with where we are today, as the sixth millennium closes, is on science itself, isn't it? And can we see, therefore, that the matrix's first three columns of the Word in the fullness of its science, Word, reflecting Word, Christ, Christianity, science, the Christ in the fullness of its science, Christ, reflecting the Word, Christ, Christianity, science, and Christianity in the fullness of its science, Christianity is the Word, Christ, Christianity, science, lead us to the fourth column itself, where the entire emphasis is on science. Now please, we're going to follow these beautiful scientific symbols which we are privileged to have the Holy Comforter teach us. Comforter, Jesus says, shall teach you all things. To follow them so easily, so gratefully, so lovingly, because it's all so spiritually, scientifically worthwhile. First then, in the fourth column, science, having the emphasis on the Word. You see it there? The Word of science. Well, clearly science must have its Word, or it couldn't be understood. And this tone, the epitome of the four tones of the Word column itself. Yes? Secondly, in the fourth column, science having the emphasis on the Christ. Well, science must have its translating mediatorial Christ, mustn't it? As the epitome of the whole of the Christ column. Or else how could science communicate itself? And thirdly, science having the emphasis on Christianity. Well, where would science be without its being demonstrable in Christianity? And this the epitome of the whole of the Christianity column. And lastly, science purely as science, or as the gathering into one transcendent compound idea of the first three sections of the science column itself. Let me say that again. Lastly, science purely as science, or as the gathering into one transcendent compound idea of the first three sections of the science column itself. Now, is that nice and clear regarding the 16-fold structure as a whole? I do hope so. Because do we see, therefore, how the four rivers of Genesis have now reached the point where they're flowing together simultaneously as just one pure river of the water of life. And because the matrix's fourth column furnishes the symbol of the golden candlestick and therefore of the very tree of life itself? Do we see how this tree, as Revelation 22 declares, is both in the midst and on either side of the single fourfold river? It is so, isn't it? And does not this tree, therefore, bear on its branches 12 manner of fruits? Think of the chapter Fruitage at the end of the textbook. Does it not bear on its two word branches, where the terms are soul and life, you see them there, the four tones, the four fruits of the word column itself? And does it not bear on its two Christ branches, where the terms are spirit and truth, the four tones, the four fruits of the Christ column? And does it not bear on its two Christianity branches, where the terms are mind and love, the four fruits of the Christianity column? And do not all six of its branches together, therefore, bear the sum total of the tree's 12 manner of fruits? They do, don't they? And far from this being just an academic letter that we're working with, can we see spiritually that what is being born to us, the fruitage which these branches of the tree are designed scientifically to bear for us, is our own truly conscious being as this exists in divine science? Just think of it. Revealing to us the sinless body of our own eternal deathless life. That's soul and life being emphasized, isn't it? Constituted of those pure qualities, that pure substance of spirit, whereby we are every whit healthy or whole. That's where the emphasis is on spirit and truth, isn't it? Think, in fact, of the actual comforter coming to us at that point. What Jesus said is the spirit of truth that proceedeth from the Father. Isn't that wonderful? And all because we are learning little by little to come forth from our origin in the one parent mind and return thence to our ultimate in the one father-mother love, as the divinely circulating cosmic activity of the all-governing divine principle itself, in the midst of which we live and move and have our being. Don't you think it's beautiful, the precision of it all? The possibility of the matrix, or womb of the Father, Mother, God, being individually reflected, made subjectively our own, whereby our identity is molded and brought to birth in the image and likeness of the total spiritual universe. No wonder we read in the textbook under the heading the leaves of healing. That the tree is typical of man's divine principle, offering full salvation, that's fullness of fruitage, from sin, sickness, and death. And that's page 406, line 5. So can we not resolve it all very simply now into the fact that the tree itself corresponds to the 7 of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, and the river into the 4 of the word Christ, Christianity, science, as the 2 transcendent divine elements of which the matrix as a whole is composed. And the 1 of which can never be bereft of the other. Because can we see that if this is so, and it is, then our own Christ mind, capital M, our own capitalized head, corresponding to the 7, can never be bereft of its body, corresponding to the 4, and neither can our body ever be bereft of its omniactive mind, through the intrusion of the tree of false mortal knowledge. You see, that's why in Revelation 22, the tree of death is no longer there, only the tree of life. In other words, there's no longer any moralistic warfare raging between forces of good and evil. To the consciousness of the tree of life, that's to say, there's no such thing as a warring tree of death. So doesn't the question inevitably arise as to how we're to account in the human experience for the seeming presence of mortality or death? And the answer is we can't. We don't account for it, for the simple reason that it's of the nature of error, a lie, or merely ignorance of scientific truth. We can't, in science, account for evil or matter as objective reality over there, against which we've got to go to war. Such a belief obtains only in a false, moralistic, religious sense of things, and not in divine science. Because what is death but an apparent absence or ignorance of the everywhere present science of life? It's impossible to account for 2 times 2 equals 5, because 2 times 2 just don't equal 5, they equal 4. And it's this true idea regarding 2 times 2 that simply needs to be understood in order to dispose of the false belief. Isn't it so? So let's turn to pages 409 and 410 in the textbook's practice chapter, where we are told we must not spend our days here in ignorance of the science of life and expect to find beyond the grave a reward for this ignorance? No, indeed. Because as Jesus says over the page, this is life eternal. This now is life eternal. Not will be then, after death. And therefore he defines everlasting life as a present knowledge. Opposite of a present ignorance, then, of his Father and of himself, the knowledge of love, truth, and life, says Science and Health. Only that which emanates from the perfection of universal love is really true, or of the nature of the wholeness of collective truth, and therefore is individual, indivisible life. The knowledge of love, truth, and life. What the science, the true knowledge of life consists of, therefore, is the conscious understanding of the indivisibility of Father and Son, God and man, principle and idea, the seven and the four, the tree of life and the river of life? No, not then. Individualized in you, me, all mankind, now, not then. Whence then, we ask, comes an apparent mortal mind as a state of self-ignorance, self-deception, self-mesmerism, existing in opposition to the science, the veritable self-knowledge of infinite immortal mind, and therefore of our present immortal deathless life? Because look at what we learn in the textbook on page 186, line 28. Mortal mind is ignorant of self, it tells us, or it could never be self-deceived, since it must believe, in something besides itself. It enthrones matter as deity. What mortal mind idolatrously worships then is matter. But the objective appearance called matter can't really be matter at all, can it? Because, in fact, it is the subjective state of mortal mind itself, and therefore is mortal mind rather than matter as such. All of which is simply the negative version of what immortal mind is forever declaring its self to be, namely, besides me, there is none else. I know myself subjectively to be infinite spirit, and am not therefore ignorant of what I am. And this forever self-knowledge on my part is the science, of my universe's eternal life. Is now, not shall be then. But even so, how come this totally illusory supposition of opposites? And Miscellaneous Writings, page 57, line 12, helps us to understand. By the law of opposites, it says, after the truth of man had been demonstrated, the postulate of error must appear. Must appear? But only as a postulate? That this addendum is untrue, the text goes on, is seen when truth, God denounced it. The opposite error said, I am true, but this was false. The history of a falsity must be told in the name of truth, or it would have no seeming. Now that's clear, isn't it? So where is it that the truth of man is demonstrated outstandingly prior to the appearing of the postulate of error, besides, of course, in the experience of Jesus at the Last Supper? Well, for example, in the unfolding of the 7 days of creation in Genesis chapter 1. That's where the truth of man is decisively shown forth, isn't it? Because after that, in the story of Adam and Eve and the serpent from Genesis 2 onwards, we have the appearing of the postulate of error. Do we see, therefore, that what we are really being asked to do is employ the method used at school in geometry and in mathematics known as reductio ad absurdum? For instance, let it be postulated that the shortest distance between the 2 points A and B on the blackboard is not, in fact, the straight line AB, but the crooked line ACB, which immediately we prove to be an incorrect absurdity by measuring and comparing the two distances AB and ACB. Or again, let us suppose that 2 plus 2 does not equal 4, but 5. And let us likewise reduce this miscalculation to the status of absurdity by adding together, say, 2 apples and 2 apples and finding the sum to be 4, not 5 apples. Because in the same way in science, let us postulate that having established the truth of man's being as God's own image in the 7 days of creation, remembering how it is said in Genesis 2:5 that there is not a man to till the ground, remember that? Let us suppose, let us postulate, that in fact there is a man to till the ground starting Genesis 2:6. Because then it is that the positive truth of the first record of creation proves by its own irrefutable logic the negative absurdity of the second. And this proof appears in our transitory human experience, of course, as our being healed of and resurrected from the postulate of mortality. So why don't we spend a little time now analyzing in a little more detail from the standpoint of the Comforter Divine Science, the Spirit of Truth, the total absurdity of the negative postulate. Shall we? We'd like to do that. Okay, let's try. Let's take it all very easily and gently. And we begin by supposing that evil does actually exist alongside good, as indeed is its claim, as postulated by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This mythology that there exists a habitation of evil outside the infinitude of the habitation of God good, outside the infinitude of the oneness of God and man, that is what today in science the Holy Comforter calls upon each one of us to reduce to absurdity at the point of our own individual spiritual consciousness. Because how can there possibly be infinity plus something? The answer is that there can't. Because from this impossible outside position, the postulate of error is that evil bombards the nuclear unity of God and man, therefore the nuclear unity of the seven and the four, with disruptive evil suggestions. Like the way we're told in modern high-energy physics, so-called neutrons are used to bombard and explosively split the nucleus of the material atom, expending, in doing so, the energy and power which resides alone in this unity. Supposedly, the bombardment, and I guess we all know what it's like to have our thought bombarded, so it seems, with disruptive evil suggestions. The bombardment sows subversively in the body of divinity, which is man, the seeds of selfish, egotistical, willful rebellion against God's divine principle, causing a breakaway of humanity from divinity, of idea, from principle, of body, from head, of the four, from the seven, corresponding to the fall of the sinful Lucifer, or in Jesus' words, causing Satan as lightning to fall from heaven. Postulating correlatively in 20th century physics a gigantic celestial explosion, the primeval so-called Big Bang precipitating a material universe made up of expanding fragments of matter, atoms, particles, stars, galaxies, and so forth. The result? What mystical religion thinks of as a sky father up there and an earth mother down here, requiring a divine human mediator in the form of a superhuman son, to come to the rescue of fallen man, heal the breach, and restore the status quo. Hence the need to human sense for the twin advents of Christ Jesus and Christian Science as the manhood and womanhood of God, to come and save mankind from the dualistic religious belief of mind little m on the one hand and matter on the other, or from the moralistic warfare involved in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that inevitably becomes the tree of death. And therefore, as the chart of the triptych shows, and as the Comforter teaches, the solution to the whole mortal problem lies in the revelation to humanity of this twofold idealism of absolute good, namely the understanding of the wedlock, of the manhood and womanhood, implicit in the onlyness of the tree of life and the river of life. So we can see, can't we, how the mythological splitting of the nuclear oneness of infinity postulates this erroneous breakaway of man from God, of mother from father, of woman from man, of earth from heaven, of humanity from divinity, all summed up finally in science as the mythical separation of the four from the seven, apparently causing, and this is the huge pointed issue, the heavenly four-square mother city of the Word, Christ, Christianity, Science, which is civilization, civilized society as this is known to the divine principle, truth, and love, as the very body of divinity itself, to fall like lightning from heaven to earth, evolving itself thereafter on a physical science and a mystical religious basis, and requiring the translation of matter back into spirit mind in order to solve for humanity the dualistic problem of mortality. Golly, I hope that's clear. Because you see, in the erroneous postulate thus assumed, mind is no longer mind, spelt with a capital M. Spirit is no longer mind's own subjective state. Identity is no longer subjective and objective one in soul. And therefore the universe as a whole is no longer under the government of infallible absolute principle, but is controlled instead by the superstitious beliefs of astrology, horoscopy, necromancy, clairvoyance, mystic psychology, animal magnetism, and so forth. Mind, in other words, is no longer immortal mind, but mortal mind, whose own subjective condition is believed to be objective matter, appearing to the physical senses as an unconscious, involuntary substratum of consciousness, separate from its own conscious stratum and working independently of it. Now, in case that feels a bit much to cope with, let's turn to Science and Health, page 409, lines 9 to 15, which puts it so very helpfully, practically, and clearly. the belief, we read, that the unconscious substratum of mortal mind termed the body suffers and reports disease independently of the so-called conscious mind is the error which prevents mortals from knowing how to govern their bodies. Now, we'd be wise, don't you think, to ponder and ponder that paragraph until we really see what it's teaching us. The analysis of mortal mind, in other words, is that it is simply a state of self-ignorance and self-deception involving a deep-seated fear of the unknown. Fear of the workings of that of which it is unconscious, and involving that most fundamental fear of all, the fear of death. A here now, followed by a hereafter on the other side of the grave. The direct opposite of knowledge of the Christly science of life, here, now, forever. The problem of this law of opposites is resolved, therefore, when we understand ourselves to be living at this very moment in the universe of spirit-mind and not in a universe of matter-mortal-mind. And with that realization, what the Comforter wants us to do, surely, is to take our thought right out into the vastness of the cosmos itself and find that its timeless outer reaches constitute the very universe of God's creation. In the words of the textbook, the eternal wonder, that infinite space, is peopled with God's ideas. The true idea of people, then, reflecting Him in countless spiritual forms. You feel the truth of the numerals of infinity and the divine infinite calculus there in those countless spiritual forms. So let's imagine, shall we, that here we are, looking out upon our universe on a beautiful starlit night, viewing the celestial sphere of the firmament of the heavens in all directions at once. Because this is where we approach the climax of this particular recording, which we're finding is supplementary to the previous eightfold set of tapes. You see, either our vision of the heavens is wholly mental and signifies for us the infinite content of the all-knowing, all-controlling, omni-active mind which is God, or else it signifies the depths of a finite cosmos of matter, of whose unseen workings we are unconscious, and the thought of which fills us with fear and foreboding. Either it is the infinitely self-conscious divine intelligence that we're contemplating, or it's an astrological, astronomical, mythological universe over which our conscious mind has no control.